Assalamu alaikum and welcome to this episode of the Afghan Eye podcast. Now in this podcast, we're going to be talking about Sardar Mohammad Dawood Khan, who was Afghanistan's first president and who was killed 43 years ago on this day in the Saud Revolution of the 28th of April 1978. Now, you see what makes this podcast special is that it was actually requested of us by one of our loyal listeners and readers. And if you know anything about us, you know anything about the Afghan Eye, then you know that we exist and we're an independently operated media platform that serves to provide a counter narrative to the mainstream coverage of Afghanistan, its culture, history and society. Now, if you want to get involved, why not email us? Email us at info@afghaneye.org, where you can send us over your recommendations, your suggestions, your comments, or you can even request us to do podcasts on certain topics that you would like to understand better, like today's podcast on Dawood Khan. And if you believe in our cause, that is to totally redefine the way in which Afghanistan is talked about at large, if you too are sick and tired of the way in which non-Afghans write for non-Afghans about Afghanistan, why not become a Patreon on our Patreon? Or you can donate to us directly on PayPal so that together, in our shared cause, we can change the way in which Afghanistan is spoken about and understood in the world at large. Finally, if you haven't subscribed to our YouTube channel, why haven't you? Subscribe to our channel, make sure you press the notification bell so you don't miss any of our latest content. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast, and I look forward to hearing from you and your suggestions over the coming weeks and months. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to episode 24 of the Afghan Eye podcast. I am Sangar Paikar.
And I'm Mahmoud Walid Kalkar, and on the 43rd anniversary of what is known in Afghanistan as the Saud Revolution, which was a communist coup d'etat in which Afghanistan's first president was killed, we're going to be looking, as requested, into the life and to the politics of Afghanistan's first president, Sardar Mohammad Dawood Khan. If you haven't done that already, please subscribe to our YouTube channel, press the notification bell if you haven't already, so you don't miss any of our latest content. And don't forget to follow us on YouTube, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. So, Sangar, 43rd anniversary of the Saud Revolution.
Yes, in my opinion, the darkest chapter of Afghanistan's recent history, because if we correctly understand what has happened in the last 40 years, most of our current problems have started this revolution is basically the start of most of our current problems. And for that reason, it is very important to know what happened before the revolution. And before the revolution, Sardar Mohammad Dawood Khan was the first president of Afghanistan, and we are going to discuss the era before the revolution by focusing on Sardar Mohammad Dawood Khan. And as you have already said in the introduction, this was a request from one of our viewer and listener. And before we dive into the topic, just one reminder: if you have any requests, if you have any suggestion, if you want to contribute in any way, make sure to send us an email, info@afghaneye.org. And we are also on Patreon, and you can become a patron of the Afghan Eye and maybe even send a donation via PayPal, of course, if you approve our content. Now I'm going to ask the first question. Let's dive into it. Ahmad Walid Kakar, can you introduce Sardar Mohammad Dawood Khan for us as a person? Who was Sardar Mohammad Dawood Khan?
So Sardar Mohammad Dawood Khan, it's in the name, Sardar, right? And Sardar was the title given to princes of the Mohammadzai royal family. And Sardar Mohammad Dawood Khan was a prince. He was the cousin of Zahir Shah. He was the Tarbur of Zahir Shah, the son of Zahir Shah's paternal uncle. He was the nephew of Nader Shah. And Nader Shah was the king that came to power in Afghanistan in 1929. After Amanullah had been deposed, Afghanistan was ruled by its first non-Pashtun king, Habibullah Kalakani. Nader Shah took the throne from Habibullah Kalakani and inaugurated what is known as the Musaiban dynasty. That was, and the reason it's known as the Musaiban dynasty was up from Dost Muhammad Khan all the way until Amanullah Khan, the Barakzai Muhammad Zai dynasty followed one successive line of descent from Dost Muhammad all the way until Amanullah. The Musaiban, however, whilst they were Muhammad Zai, they were different. They were descended from the brother of Dost Muhammad Khan, a man called Sultan Muhammad Khan al-Tilayi, who was the governor of Peshawar and who we discussed in a previous podcast as being the one who made the fateful decision to ally with Ranjit Singh to protect himself from his own brother, Dost Muhammad. And in the end, Peshawar slipped out of his authority, out of Afghan authority, became to be ruled by the Sikhs and after that by the British. So Nader Shah and after him Zahir Shah and Sardar Muhammad Dawood Khan were descended from that line of the Muhammad Zai family, royal family. And so that essentially is what distinguishes the Musaiban from, we could say, the Dost Muhammad Khil, which included Sher Ali Khan, which included Abdul Rahman Khan, Habibullah Khan, Amanullah Khan. And if we're talking about Dawood Khan in particular, he was the son of Muhammad Aziz Khan. Muhammad Aziz Khan was the half-brother of King Nader, and he was assassinated in Berlin, I presume because of a conspiracy by the Charkhi family, in which Nader Shah's family was targeted. And it really and truly, he was the inaugurator, the creator of the Afghan Republic. Although the credentials of the Afghan Republic, we can really question. They're like a lot of other republics in our part of the world, in the Islamic world, where we're told we have a republic, but power is concentrated on the basis of either ethnicity or religion, or in the case of Dawood Khan, strictly on a clan basis.
Okay, so Sardar Muhammad Dawood Khan was born as a prince in a royal family. What was his education? Where did he grow up? Where did he study? What were his hobbies?
With regard to hobbies, I haven't been privy to any information that has detailed that. Apart from, you know, the very romantic nostalgia about him being a man of learning, a passionate, patriotic man, a deeply devout religious man. But Dawood studied in the school of in Kabul called Amaniyah, which was established by Amanullah Khan and which ran a German curriculum. Dawood later went on to study in France. And what differed him from what distinguished him from Zahir was that Zahir, his cousin, studied at Lycée Estiqlal, which was French run and had a French curriculum. So Dawood, because of this, was very much in contact and exposed to Germany, German ideas, German publications. And this is at a time in which the Muslim world in general is starting to really become influenced in sort of the post-colonial age, or as we're approaching the post-colonial age with the Second World War, by deeply nationalist, modernist ideals. So Dawood himself read German publications, and he was deeply influenced by sort of Adolf Hitler's one nation, one people, one leader. And that isn't to say that Dawood also wanted to genocide 6 million Jews, but rather it was a radical, or it was a break insofar that Afghanistan as a multi-ethnic society is something that Dawood himself saw as a hindrance. Dawood himself was very keen on modernizing Afghanistan, modernizing it quickly. And part and parcel of that modernization, in Dawood's view, was to consolidate Afghanistan around one identity, one language, one group of people. And that was the ethnicity to which he belonged, which were the Pashtuns. On top of that, it's said that he was actually ashamed of his ancestor, Sultan Muhammad Khan Atilayi, because it was his ancestor who basically put the foundations in place inadvertently for Afghan authority east of what is now the Durand Line, came to an end because of his ancestor. So Dawood was very passionate and emotional about the plight of Pashtuns, his fellow co-ethnic Pashtuns east of the Durand Line. And he was also very keen on modernizing Afghanistan under the sort of the aesthetic of the Pashtun, in which Pashtuns played the role of kingmakers or the arbiters, the creators of Afghanistan.
Very interesting. So this is something that basically could be said as a general problem in most countries that were previously colonized or occupied. Mm-hmm. In the first half of the 20th century, many educated elites in the Muslim world, they adopted what was then seen as modern and novel ideas. Nationalism was a modern and dominant idea that resulted in the First and Second World War, the Holocaust, and many atrocities in Western Europe. But in our part of the world, those ideas were not seen as a major problem. They were just seen as new ideas that may have positive influences and positive effects. We could also make a comparison with Iraq and Syria, because the Ba'ath Party, the founders of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq and Syria, they were also inspired by French and German nationalism, and they also espoused some of those very radical and extreme views and ideas. Anyway, I think that it is very interesting that you have mentioned this, because for most Afghans who have these very romantic and naive view of what it means to be an Afghan nationalist, mm-hmm. and be patriotic, they have to know where the roots are of these ideas. And
I think you hit the nail on the head, because look, I mean, this is a time in which the Muslim world, especially after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, is subjected to, let's say, colonialism, formal or informal. And colonialism, from what Muslim elites can see, is facilitated by the strength of Western nation states. Okay, the power and the capacity of Western nation states to accumulate resources, men, material, arms, and to organize large-scale violence. This is the essence of European colonialism in the modern world. And in order to have that strong nation state, you don't just have to have a strong industrial base for a strong military, but you also needed to have a strong identity. So it's not just enough for a polity or a government to rule over a disparate group of people and to accept all of their identities. No, what you needed to have, according to these people, were people that identified very strongly with that government, which would facilitate that government or that state to be able to mobilize and organize mass violence toward promoting its own interests, whether at home or abroad. So according to these elites, like you said, this was just out with the old and in with the new. Multi-ethnic societies may have worked for us before, but now they're not working because we are now the weaker ones, and we need to essentially replicate the European model in order to fight the European model. And yeah, that's where the problem lies.
I don't want to make a huge sidetrack because we are discussing Daoud Khan, but I think it is a very important point that we should shortly discuss now, is that this whole idea that the nation state needs to be created, and that the nation state needs to have one single ethnic linguistic identity, is something that is deeply problematic in a society like Afghanistan, where we have so many different ethnic groups, different languages, different customs, and we have this constant tension that is going on right now in Kabul. We have a Pashtun nationalist group supporting Ashraf Ghani, and we have Tajik nationalists and Hazara nationalists and Turkic nationalists like Uzbeks, etc. And they all aspire to have their own nation state entirely based on their own language, on their own culture. And this desire that they have has only one consequence, and that is conflict. Conflict, hostility, and endless instability in the region. Mm-hmm. And sadly, this idea is mainly a obsession of the educated elite. You don't see the common villager, the semi-literate villager, who are, the villagers who are 70% of Afghanistan, you don't see them having these ideas. This is a hobby of those who are well endowed with all these abilities to read books and talk about abstract ideas. They are causing this problem. So anyway, now that we have discussed this, let's go back to Daoud Khan. So Daoud Khan was educated in Amonia. He studied in Germany.
In France.
In France. And once he graduated, once he was done with his education, what was his first profession?
So he graduated from Harbiya military school in 1932. He was made a major general then. But you see, Dawood was the son of Muhammad Aziz Khan. And after Nader Khan was killed in 1933, the brothers of Nader Khan were the ones that ruled, okay, up until 1953. So for two decades, it was not Zahir ruling, it was Zahir's uncles. And a lot of these uncles were born of two different wives. So there was a classic case of polygamous household, different offspring sort of forming their own separate camps. Now, Dawood was very heavily promoted, Dawood and his brother Naeem were heavily promoted by the Afghan Prime Minister Muhammad Hashim Khan, who was unmarried, died single, never had any children, and he was their full uncle, and he essentially treated them as his adopted children, especially after their father died. So Hashim promoted Dawood and made him the civilian and military governor of Kandahar in 1935, whereas Dawood's brother, Muhammad Naeem, was made deputy minister of foreign affairs. Now, it's at this time, whilst Dawood is in Kandahar, you sort of have in Kandahar a movement to sort of promote the Pashto language. Now, we need to sort of divorce and separate this from the nation state talk that we just talked about of sort of a monolingual, mono-ethnic state. In Kandahar at this time, there was also a practical need for the government to promote the use of Pashto. After Nader took the throne from Habibullah Kalakani in 1929, the state had broken down. The state that had been built from the time of Abdurrahman to Habibullah to Amanullah to Kalakani had broken down. A new civilian bureaucracy had to be essentially instituted, a new civil service, and this civil service was predominantly Pashtun, okay? And the civil service and bureaucracy in Afghanistan, all the way from the time of Ahmad Shah, who relied on the Qizilbash, was conducted heavily in the Persian language, in Dari. Now, when the civil service came to be staffed mainly by Pashtuns who didn't speak Dari, this became a problem. So there was a practical need for Pashto to be promoted by the government in order to govern properly. And on top of that, there was also sort of a linguistic awakening or consciousness amongst the intelligentsia, especially in Kandahar, of the need to standardize the Pashto language, to make it a literary canon, for it to become a viable language, as opposed to the lingua franca Dari being used ad infinitum. Okay? So Dawood at this time comes into Kandahar. He becomes a civilian and military governor. And at this time, he starts to gain the nickname of Lewanay Dawood, Crazy Dawood, okay? As a reputation for sort of a harsh man who doesn't like to take nonsense, who has a bit of an erratic temperament, is very emotional and whatever. And he forms and builds ties with these local Pashtun leaders, which culminates sort of in the formation of what we know as Pashto Tolena in 1937. Pashto Tolena was an organization that, like I mentioned, wanted to promote the Pashto language and standardized eventually the Pashto language. That's something as Pashtuns that we look at very positively, because it was thanks to Pashto Tolena and all of the poets and the experts in the Pashto language that we now have a standardized acceptable script of Pashto all the way from Helmand to Peshawar that's accepted and understood by all Pashtuns. So that was the basic context of the need for the Pashto language to be promoted. Dawood at this time is in Kandahar and is also becoming, once again, deeply influenced by these ideas. One language, one people, one leader under a centralized leadership and government. And so it was in this context that Dawood made alliances with different people in Kandahar, not just in Kandahar, but also outside of Kandahar in the east of the country. And a lot of these alliances were done with people that didn't just want to promote the Pashto language in general, but that wanted to institute the rule of Pashtuns and who were quite frankly racists. And Dawood used these alliances to propel himself further up the ladder. So when his uncle, Muhammad Hashim Khan, resigned in 1946, the following year, there was a movement called Wish Zarmian that was founded. Do you know anything about Wish Zarmian, Salman?
Yes. Wish Zarmian, I have a book here by Batsarkay. Batsarkay was a member of Wich Zarmian. He used to live here in the Netherlands. I think he died a few years ago. It's a very interesting book. Wich Zarmian was sort of a predecessor of the Hezb-e Demokratik Khalq Afghanistan, the Communist Party. Obviously, Wich Zarmian weren't all communists, but some of their members later
Taraki on... Taraki amongst them.
Yes, Nur Muhammad Taraki. Many of these men, they later became communists. Now, why is it's a very good point that you have brought up now, because Wich Zarmian, as a movement, it was a predominantly a Pashtun movement from the south. There were some members in Kabul and other areas, but most of their leaders, most of their most influential figures were from the deep south, from the southwest, like Kandahar and those areas. And this movement was a progressive movement. They were inspired by certain ideas of Western enlightenment. Okay. But it was a very heterogeneous movement. There were different people from different persuasions who were all part of Wich Zarmian. And Wich Zarmian means awakened youth. These guys were really woke, okay? So they were woke youth of first part of the 20th century. So for all the millennials who are listening, Wich Zarmian means woke youth.
Yeah.
So Wich Zarmian, the group, the movement, they had very religious people among them, imams, scholars.
My grandfather.
Yes, your grandfather was a member.
He was a Maulawi, by the way, not a communist.
And then you had all these other figures who were more secular and less inspired by religion. But this is something that most of our youth need to understand, is that in that particular era in Afghanistan, the Weak Salmian movement was basically a fertile community that was still evolving, and people wanted to have a more representative system of government. They wanted to see Afghanistan develop economically. They wanted to see more people being educated. Those were very important ideas that brought a lot of people together in Weak Salmian. But because it was a political movement, the rulers, they saw them as a threat.
The thing is, and we come back to Dawood here, Dawood himself, a lot of the ideals that Weak Salmian, and here we come with Sha versus Kha Pashto. Yeah. In any case, a lot of the ideas that Weak Salmian actually promoted were ideas of nationalism, patriotism, a resolution of the Pashtunistan issue, which was hot back then. And these sorts of things were, Dawood essentially, first of all, he sympathized with these ideas. He once again used this movement to cultivate himself and new allies for his future political career. And a lot of these ideas were things that he genuinely believed in. So once I mentioned in my Durand Line article as well, that the Durand Line issue and the Pashtunistan issue was what Dawood used and instrumentalized to facilitate his own political ascent. And in the same way, Weak Salmian was just a vehicle for this. So whilst Weak Salmian was actually something that Dawood used and exploited, a popular movement whose momentum he rode to the prime ministership, he did this to weaken his uncle Shah Mahmud. So Weak Salmian were eventually disbanded, its members were imprisoned, its leading members, people like Pohan Abdulhai Habibi, who's Afghanistan's, let's say, one of Afghanistan's most preeminent historians, had to flee the country. The movement itself cracked down, but whilst there had been an initial period of parliamentary politics, and the damage had been done, if we can say that, there had been the lid had been lifted. The royal family had come under very strong criticism after two decades of very authoritarian, autocratic rule. And it was as such that with weakening his uncle, Dawood was able, on the basis of an agreement with Zahir Shah, to essentially force his uncle to resign and take over the reins of leadership in the form of a prime minister himself.
Well, that's a very important point that I want to shortly discuss. You said that Weak Salmian, basically, they all ended up in prison, okay?
All in exile.
Yeah, they were all in either in exile or they ended up in prison. And this is also a very important point that we need to compare to other movements in another time frame in other part of the world. You see, the Muslim Brotherhood was a similar movement, a political movement. They were more inspired by Islam. It was a counter-movement to colonialism. They were less inspired by nationalism. But the Muslim Brotherhood as a movement, when their leaders all ended up in prison, when those guys spent the 60s and 70s in prison, when they came out of prison, they were much more radical and much more extreme. And basically, the Salafi jihadi ideology of Al-Qaeda and Daesh, is a product of the Egyptian and Syrian prison system.
Yep.
And this is something that people should understand, is that when Wikselmian, when they ended up in prison, a lot of their leaders, when they came out of prison, they were communists. They only believed in overthrowing the regime with brute force. And this is a problem with many ideological movements in our part of the world. Repression has often resulted in radicalization and driving those political movements into extreme paths. Now, with regard to Sardar Mohammad Daoud Khan, would you say that he, as a political leader, in the first part of the 20th century, was he really someone who wanted to implement those nationalist ideas, and that he actually tried to pursue a path of creating a nation state entirely based on one ethnicity and language? If yes, what did he do exactly in the first part of the 20th century?
Well, I don't think it's, whilst we can sort of point to his actions, and there's sort of a consistent sort of undertone that he himself was very nationalistic, and his nationalism was based on sort of an ethnic chauvinism of one ethnicity. At the same time, he wasn't sort of opposed to allying or working with non-Pashtuns. Indeed, later on, when he became president, in the coup d'etat in 1973, he sort of spoke about the rights of national minorities. He did have non-Pashtuns in his parliament. He worked with non-Pashtuns like Babrak Karmal. So whilst the ideological aspect is there, there's little sort of evidence to say that he himself was sort of genocidal in his nationalism. But at the same time, it is very true that he saw the Pashtunistan issue not as sort of a foreign policy issue. He saw it as something that was domestic politics. That's why he would, the two issues for him were tied. It wasn't a sort of a separate sort of thing for him.
Now, there was a little bit of a discussion recently on Twitter about who is and who isn't a Pashtun. So okay. I'm going to bring this up now. Did Sardar Mohammad Daoud Khan actually speak Pashto?
According to my sources, he did. He did speak Pashto, although he didn't speak it very well. So Dari was his first language, and obviously he was an impeccable speaker of Dari. And he also spoke Pashto not that well, however. But that being said, he was very keen on the promotion of Pashto as a language that Pashtuns and non-Pashtuns had to learn. And there's a funny story, and I know this from my family, is that in Pashto, how do we say 14, Sangar?
Swarless.
Okay. Well, Dawood used to say Talorless.
Okay.
So he was getting there. He was getting there, but it wasn't perfect.
Yeah, so this is an issue that I think it's important for most people to understand, is that in Afghanistan, at least that's my personal opinion, okay? We have many Pashtuns who are Farsiwan. They are Pashtun by lineage, but they speak Farsi. And those people, in many instances, you see that when they get this sort of awakening that they are actually Pashtun, they become very toxic and hostile towards Dari language, and they say we need to have Pashto as just one language, and everybody needs to speak Pashto. But they themselves, they can't speak Pashto. I've had this encounter with an Afghan here in the Netherlands about 18 years ago, I think. There was a cultural event in this country of Afghans, and there were a lot of these Khalkis and Parchamis at that event. And they were having this cultural event, and everybody was saying, okay, we need to celebrate our culture and everything. And they said, we should do a tan. Okay, so most of these guys, they didn't know how to do it. So I started doing a tan. And when I was finished, a lot of these guys came to me and said, you made us proud. As Pashtuns, we feel very proud because you preserve our culture. And they were all spoke in Dari. And I noticed that. And I was like, but you're speaking Dari. So what's going on? He said, no. I'm actually Pashtun. I'm very proud of my identity. And I've seen many people who have this tendency. And I would say maybe Dawood Khan, he was inspired by those.
Fell victim to that.
Yes. I mean,
you know, I'm not going to go too deep into the psychology of it, but when I guess, you know, identity is a very important thing for a human being. And when humans feel like their identity is under threat, it sort of makes them, as we would say in Pashto, it makes them put two feet in one shoe, like really sort of overemphasizing certain things. So I wouldn't be surprised at all. But it was known that while sort of the elder generation, people like Nadir Khan or I suspect Shah Mahmud and Muhammad Hashim, and these guys were fluent in Pashto. And I'd say I suspect because obviously no one back then was taking notes to list in CVs, but if they were fighting with Pashtun tribes and living in Pashtun areas and had Pashtun tribesmen in their divisions and brigades, then it's it's safe to assume that they were at least fluent in the language, even if it wasn't their first language. Dawood and Zahid, however, from what I've heard, they could understand Pashto, they could sort of speak it, but not sort of fluently, sort of at an intermediate kind of level. And as I said, talorless instead of twalless is a bit funny for us because it's a bit of an infantile mistake to make.
Okay, so we've covered his ideas about identity, nationality, language, but obviously he was a progressive man. And as a progressive, he is also known for his ideas about modernization of the state, modernization of the economy, the infrastructure. What can you tell us about that?
So after Nadir took the throne, the idea of modernization itself was deeply discredited in Afghanistan. And for anyone that wants to know more about that, they can refer to our podcast on Amanullah Khan. Perhaps one day we'll write an article about Amanullah Khan to clarify things in a written format. The idea of modernization itself was one that was deeply tainted and almost taboo. So what the Musaiban did was that they focused primarily on infrastructure, on sort of not social reform, but sort of industrial reform. Reforms aimed at sort of boosting the state's revenues, which would allow it to maintain a large military force. And you know how the story goes after that. But what happened in 1941 was that with the outbreak of the Second World War, Britain and Russia, or the Soviet Union, made an ultimatum to the Afghan government to deport all German, Japanese, and Italian civilian workers working in Afghanistan. And they made the similar ultimatum to Iran. And when Iran didn't comply, they invaded Iran. Okay? So what happened was that Muhammad Hashim Khan agreed. He convened the lawyer Jirga. We covered this in our podcast on lawyer Jirgas as well. The Afghan Prime Minister Muhammad Hashim Khan, the uncle of Dawood, convened the lawyer Jirga, in which he made a declaration that fine, we will deport these civilian workers on the condition that they're given safe passage. And he also used the opportunity to increase taxes and to introduce conscription. So he used this ultimatum for domestic political benefit. But that really made the Afghan royal family and Afghans realize once again that despite the fact that they were formally, officially independent, that independence was very, very unstable and insecure, because in the event of an invasion by one of the two, the Soviet Union or British India, what could Afghanistan really do? So it was that experience that really once again emphasized the need for modernization. A lot of the times we sort of look at modernization and we think that, you know, it's some sort of heretic or deviant. Afghans especially will look at, you know, this is a heretical, deviant idea. But there was the understanding that without modernization, Afghanistan would once again be invaded, occupied, its people would suffer. So it was needed. Right, modernization was needed to protect Afghanistan, and Dawood Khan really appreciated that. And in his own quotes, he sort of said that the problems of Afghanistan will take two generations to solve. So they were very much aware of the fact that modernization was something that was necessary, it wasn't a choice, and that it was something that would take a very long time. And so when Dawood became prime minister, once again, like I said, Dawood's ethno-nationalism was part and parcel of his modernization drive. He saw the two going hand in hand. His ethno-nationalism would feed into a strong nation state, and that strong nation state, with a lot of people, would be more powerful, could enact its own agenda. The two things worked hand in glove. And so when he became prime minister, he adopted a very belligerent stance towards Pakistan. And at the same time, he also wanted to make overtures to the United States. Dawood was aware that Afghanistan had to remain neutral in the Cold War. However, the United States declined his offers for closer relations because it said that Dawood first needed to solve his issues with Pakistan over the Pashtunistan issue. And so when rejected by the United States, Dawood made, we could say, the first of his major blunders, which was getting close to the Soviet Union. So in 1955, he bought a lot of weapons from the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union gave Afghanistan very generous loans, and he signed an agreement with the Soviet Union in which the military officers of the Afghan army would be trained in the Soviet Union. For those people that don't know, being trained in the Soviet Union as a military officer meant like a 3-4 year program of brainwashing into Marxist-Leninism. Okay? And the problem with this was that while sort of medical professionals were sent, I don't know, to Europe, America, Turkey, the military was the kingmaker in Afghanistan. And Dawood initiated this trend of sending the Afghan military, or at least its highest ranking officers, into the Soviet Union, where they were readily brainwashed. On top of that, he also initiated 5-year plans. Okay, and just the 5-year plan shows how much of an influence sort of the Soviet Union was in these. Now, these 5-year plans were financed by domestic revenues, and they were also financed by foreign loans and grants. Now, Dawood failed to finance these 5-year plans adequately with domestic revenues, which meant that under him, Afghanistan became sort of a rentier state, because it was relying very heavily on foreign loans and grants from the United States, from Soviet Union as well, from smaller powers like Britain, like Germany, like Italy. It was relying on foreign powers for its own modernization. And so it was with that in mind that under Dawood, the Afghan state became a rentier state. Okay, he became very reliant, especially on the Soviets. And once again, sort of achievements of his prime ministership go to sort of things like the Helmand Valley Project, which was a vast sort of agricultural project which aimed to irrigate land in sort of the Helmand River Delta in southern Afghanistan, so that a lot of people were lifted out of poverty, agricultural output increased, whatever. So these, and that was done by the United States. However, once again, you know, there was in 1959, Dawood made the, he was also, let's say, a social liberal in Afghanistan's context. In 1959, in the Independence Day parade, he essentially ordered the women of the royal family to appear without chadari, to without a headscarf. And he essentially, when that aroused opposition from the ulama, especially from the Hazrat Sayyid Mujaddidi, Dawood essentially said, look, this is a matter of choice. So you could see what the pattern of his thought was that modernization was something that was also extended to the religious sphere. Now, this was obviously different to Amanullah, who forcefully unveiled women, but sort of the rationale and the thinking was there. Now, Dawood's, the second of his major blunders, was that he involved Afghanistan in a tribal quarrel in Bajawar. Now, for those people who don't know what Bajawar is or where it was almost captured by Amir Abdurrahman in the late 1880s or the early 1890s until the British government gave him an ultimatum that Bajawar was a place that he could not conquer. But in Bajawar, there was a tribal sort of series of infighting, and Dawood essentially and his government aided the Khan of Jandul. I hope I'm reading that correctly because I haven't read it in Pashto. I've only read the transliterated English. But he supported the Nawab of Deer and the Khan of Jandul against the rival Khan, who was backed by Pakistan. In that tribal fight, Dawood sent some Afghan soldiers disguised as tribesmen, and Dawood's side lost. Pakistan took advantage of that opportunity. It deposed the Nawab of Deer, and it occupied territory which it had never administered before. Now, that led to a breakdown of relations, okay, between Afghanistan and Pakistan, naturally. And the Durand Line was closed. A lot of the aid, a lot of the material that was destined for Afghanistan to travel through Karachi and the Durand Line to Afghanistan was stopped. The USSR, once again, the Soviet Union, provided an alternative transit route, and that further highlighted how reliant Dawood was on the Soviet Union. All of this caused a severe economic depression, and ultimately, a couple of elite Muhammadzi Dawood, Zahir Shah, came together and they decided enough was enough. Dawood had run Afghanistan into a corner. He was increasingly autocratic. His leadership was erratic, and essentially, that was the end of his prime ministership. He was forced to resign.
Okay, there was so much to unpack here. Okay, so first of all, you discussed modernism. Something that we always see is that modernity is seen as something that came about because of freedom of thought and freedom of ideas. But the driving force behind modernity was the war between different states in Europe and their competition in the mercantilist era. Mercantilism was also discussed in our previous podcast with Dr. Ruger. But in that era, 300 years ago, all these royal families in Europe were engaged in a competition with each other. They tried to colonize other parts of the world. They believed that they need to modernize their army and their navy so that they can compete with each other. And that competition led to discovery of new weapons, new technology. And that's how these states in Europe became very powerful. So when Dawood Khan was basically trying to create a modern state, he was also trying to reenact that process. However, the things that you've mentioned, what is really, in my opinion, something that we should try to understand more, and I would like to know if this theory is correct. Some people say that Dawood Khan basically single-handedly decided to impose a blockade against Pakistan and close the borders, which means that as a landlocked country, Afghanistan, by its own volition, decided to close its access points to goods coming through Pakistan into Afghanistan. Is that true?
Somewhat so, yeah. So Pakistan didn't close the Durand Line crossings, but it closed the consulates of Afghanistan in Pakistan, which Dawood said was akin to an economic blockade.
You mentioned...
So the border was closed, yes. Right? The crossings were closed, yes. But it wasn't, to my knowledge, from what I've read, and the history also just says the border was closed, the crossings were closed, sort of shipments were halted. But to the best of my knowledge, Pakistan did not sort of enforce that. That was sort of just a byproduct of what happened with Pakistan closing consulates of Afghanistan.
You mentioned something else that is very interesting and that is also relevant even today. Mm-hmm. Afghanistan is situated in a place where we are very dependent on Pakistan.
Yeah.
And during the Cold War, as you've mentioned, the United States said to Dawood Khan, basically, you need to sort out your relationship with Pakistan in order to receive aid from us.
Well, they did give aid, but
yes,
they didn't give as much as they would have.
Yeah.
Had Dawood Khan sorted out his problems with Pakistan.
Yeah. And then another, if we go even further, another big problem is that when we have these modernist and these enlightened progressive rulers, whether it's Ashraf Ghani now or Dawood Khan or all these rulers, they all wanted a process of modernization, but entirely dependent on aid.
Yes.
Their understanding of economy and development was entirely based on, we need to get free money so that we can develop our country, without even understanding that there is no such a thing as a free lunch. Nobody gives you money so that you can be prosperous and developed and whatnot. There is something you have to do in return. And I think that that's a lesson that is very hard to learn for many Afghan rulers, because you see that being repeated over and over for the last couple of decades.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So, okay. So he was basically fired from his role as prime minister,
mm-hmm.
By his cousins.
By his cousin and his brother-in-law, because yes. He was married to Zahir's sister.
Yes. Okay. So when he was fired, it was a culmination of all his blunders that resulted into him being fired.
Yeah, so I mean, I think we'll take sort of a balanced perspective. Things like the Helmand Valley project, the expansion of the armed forces, these sorts of things, we could say the expansion of the civil bureaucracy, whatever. These are things that you could say are to his credit. However, how were those things achieved? Overwhelming reliance on the Soviet Union, which is never a good idea, ever.
Yeah.
And, belligerence to Pakistan that essentially caused economic crash, which is also never a good thing. And so his cousin, Zahir Shah, and his brother-in-law, Zahir Shah, essentially, and Zahir Shah had sat by on the sidelines for 3 decades, being sidelined first by his cousins and then by Dawood, had enough and had decided that he wanted to actually rule as a king. A lot of times people say Zahir Shah ruled for 4 decades. For 3 of those 4 decades, it was his cousin and his uncles that were sidelining him. This was the time of political maturity for Zahir Shah. And with everything together, with the fact that this was his brother-in-law and his cousin, it's like the most nightmare version of Terburi that you can find in Pashtun culture.
Yeah, so maybe you can briefly explain what that is, because I think most of our listeners, they don't understand that.
Terburi refers to the rivalry that exists between sons of paternal uncles. Because Pashtuns are a patrilineally descended group, and the society is generally patriarchal, authority passes from father to son, which oftentimes causes conflicts between not just brothers, but between cousins from paternal uncles. And that essentially is the rivalry that it refers to.
And there is another aspect to this, is that Afghanistan as a traditional country, in a pre-modern country, the culture, the environment, the economy, agriculture is in a way, the way it is, that resources are very scarce. Water is very, there isn't enough water, there isn't enough arable land. So when families grow, conflicts arise because of the share of water and land that each family needs to live off. And when those resources are scarce, then it's unavoidable to have conflicts. And most of these conflicts between families in our part of the world is also caused because of scarcity of resources for families. But these guys, they were the elite, they were the royal family. And for them,
well, they were also from rival branches of the same family, because there's also a polygamous household. So they come from different grandmothers, you see, and that also exacerbates certain things. And if you know Afghan society, you know how polygamous it also is. So
yes,
the ingredients were all there. But yeah, to cut the long story short, the king, Zahir Shah, stepped in. Dawood resigned, and Zahir Shah, from 1963 to 1973, ruled as king.
Okay. So what happened when he was deposed and left his position?
So in 1964, a new constitution was signed into law. The new constitution formally made Afghanistan a constitutional monarchy. There was a Mashranu Jirga, upper house of representatives, or the Jirga of elders, and there was a Walasi Jirga, which was the house of the people. And that Walasi Jirga included people like Maulawi Muhammad Nabi Muhammadi, who was representing his constituency in Logar, included people like Babrak Karmal. But what that constitution also stipulated was that members of the Afghan royal family were not allowed to partake in politics. And that was done very deliberately to exclude Dawood Khan from entering politics sort of as an independent, because after he'd been fired as prime minister, he was a prince and prime minister, there were fears that Dawood Khan could sort of go his own way, create his own political party and become the prime minister once again. So that obviously ostracized Dawood Khan, and it angered him very strongly. And after that, you sort of had what's known as the constitutional decade. Okay, so you had a number of different prime ministers. So first you had Dr. Muhammad Yusuf, who was appointed by Zahir Shah. His premiership failed. Dr. Yusuf, I believe, was a Tajik or an Uzbek. After that, you had Muhammad Hashim Maywandwal, who was Ahmad Zay, I believe, from around the south. And he was very deeply opposed to communism. His prime ministership didn't really work. This was a very turbulent history in Afghanistan's history.
Yeah. I think Maywandwal was also a Wikzalmay.
Okay, yeah, probably.
Yeah.
But Maywandwal himself was a monarchist, very deeply opposed to communism, sort of a conservative kind of character. And a lot of the times people sort of look at the constitutional decade as sort of a failed experiment. But I think that's a very naive way of looking at it, and I'll explain sort of the challenges of the constitutional decade. But if we look at, let's say, the way parliamentary politics has developed and evolved in Britain, you had the civil wars, English civil wars, you had the Commonwealth of England headed by Oliver Cromwell, you had the Glorious Revolution of William of Orange coming over, instituting a new monarchy. Sangar will know about William of Orange because he was a Dutch king.
I am from the city, Leiden, the city of William of Orange.
Okay, there we go. But the evolution of parliamentary politics, if we look at it from the British perspective, which is how this stuff took decades and centuries. So to look at the Afghan experiment, which lasted a decade, and say, oh, the prime minister was appointed by the king, oh, it failed, it couldn't address the solutions of the problem. There are many periods of British history where the country has been sort of gripped by multiple crises and whatever. There's no panacea to a lot of these issues. And so this is the first sort of experiment of Afghanistan with sort of a parliamentary politics. And to say that, well, the king has a lot of powers, it's not really a constitutional monarchy. But then we look at countries like Jordan, okay, where the king has a lot of executive power. No one really looks at that and says this failed. So the point I'm making is that a 10-year experiment with parliamentary politics under a premise of a constitutional monarchy is a very short time frame. And Afghans and non-Afghans alike would do very well to sort of look at this period of history sensibly and not sort of reactionarily and retrospectively. But in any case, that's my run over. After Maywand Wal, you had Nur Ali Etemadi, who was a Muhammad Zay. He was very authoritarian. His repression backfired. You had the father of Ahmad Zahir, who was the friend of Zahir Shah, who was briefly prime minister, Abdul Zahir. And then you had Muhammad Musa Shafiq, who was arguably the most competent of all of these prime ministers. He was the king's favorite. The amount of royal backing given to Shafiq was unrivaled. Shafiq put the adhan in the national radio. He was religiously educated. He was a Maulawi, but he'd also received a liberal arts education. He'd studied law as well. He'd studied in Al-Azhar. And he had also taken action against Christian missionary societies. He rejected Soviet proposals for a cultural center in Kabul. And this was, at the time, the man seen as finally being the one to remedy Afghanistan's ills. So Afghanistan was gripped with a massive national debt, partly thanks to Dawood. There were workers' strikes, and a famine took place. And the Afghan government had no real prior experience with crisis management. So from the late 60s to the early 70s, tens of thousands of people, unfortunately, died in the famine, and none of these prime ministers were seemingly able to sort it out. And so Musa Shafiq was sort of seen as the guy, young, dynamic, sort of the problem solver who could solve this. However, Musa Shafiq rejecting a cultural center of the Soviet Union in Kabul alarmed the Soviets and alarmed the communists with whom Dawood was now allied. Musa Shafiq also realized that Afghanistan was still sort of massive national debt. It needed financial aid. And so he negotiated a treaty with Iran in which the waters of the Helmand River were sort of distributed, and it was a generous deal for the Iranians that was very heavily opposed by Dawood and other people in Afghanistan. But Iran also offered, you know, loads of financial aid for that. So Shafiq was sort of seen as a proactive guy who could fix things. He was sort of the king's favorite. But and also, this constitutional decade saw an improvement in Afghanistan-Pakistan relations. So in the India-Pakistan War of 1965, Afghanistan sort of gave assurances to Pakistan that it was neutral, it wouldn't pose any sort of security threat. And also, tribal Afghans on the Afghan side of the Durand line also went to fight with the Pakistanis against the infidel Hindus. And the Afghan government absolutely did not stop that at all. It let that happen. It didn't see any problems with that. And so in 1966, Ayub Khan visited Kabul. And in the following year, Zahir Shah visited Pakistan. So whilst the constitutional decade had many issues, there were loads of challenges, the famine that killed tens of thousands of people, economic crises. There were also promising signs of sort of reverting away from, let's say, the belligerent attitudes that Dawood had adopted.
Okay, before we move on, I have a few questions, okay? First, you mentioned the famine. This brings to mind a very scary story that I used to hear from my mother as a child. She would say that there was a famine in Afghanistan, in Chakhcharan, in Ghor.
Yeah.
And many people died, and she was a very young girl when this famine happened. And she would remember that people in Kabul were saying that people are dying from hunger, and people would come all the way from Ghor to Kabul in hope that they can maybe survive and get any food. But on their way from Chekhcheran to Kabul, a lot of people died. And I think this famine and these economic crises that happened in the 60s and 70s, they have created an environment in Afghanistan that was a sort of precursor to major events that were going to happen after that. You mentioned that Daoud Khan was very close to the Russians. You also mentioned that he basically sent the top brass of the army to study in Soviet Union. He is also known as the Red Prince. When did he get this title?
So he got the title from his inaugural address and some of the policies that he adopted after he launched a coup d'etat in 1973. So we've covered essentially the
challenge. So wait. So the Red Prince title came after his coup in 1973.
I think, to the best of my knowledge, yes. I mean, he was always sort of seen as a statist, sort of left-leaning prince. But given the context of the 73 coup, which was that it was staffed very heavily by leftists, by communists, and then the agenda that he attempted to implement in after 73, the title of Red Prince became much more prominent for him.
Okay. So he was known as Leonid Daoud when he was in Kandahar, and then later he was called
the Red Prince.
The Red Prince. So interesting. But you mentioned that his policies in the 50s have resulted into an economic crisis, famine. The country was in debt, buried in debt. And, you know, to be honest, I think this is something most Afghans never heard of. Most young Afghans, they don't know this. But it is very important to pay attention here is that when you have a very progressive and liberal president who wants to modernize the state in a very fast pace and do all kinds of new things, new ideas, those new ideas may seem very attractive. They may seem like they're good ideas, but we see that after a while, when those ideas are implemented, that they have disastrous effects. Now, this doesn't mean that you should never try new things. However, I think that the major difference in Afghanistan between the progressives and the conservatives is often that the progressives, they portray the conservatives as you reject modernity, you reject progress, you don't want education, you don't want nothing. And we want...
You are a supporter of the darkness.
Yes. But on the other hand, if we look at these progressives, whether it's Amanullah Khan, Daoud Khan, the communists and the people now in power, they have this idea that what they're doing is for the greater good of all Afghans.
It sounds very religious. It's almost like their jihad.
Yes.
And another point that needs to be mentioned as well is that these sort of erratic, state-centered, top-down approaches at reform always fail, okay?
Yes.
According to the track record. And when they fail, the country is further damaged. It goes further, if we're talking about this progressive or regressive, the country further goes regressive. So the more that they attempt to do it, the more that it's attempted to be done, the more the country regresses, the more these people are radicalized. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You see, because whenever the state goes back, then you get the partisans saying, well, the reason it didn't work the first time is because we didn't try hard enough. Maybe we should do it even more. You see, and that is essentially, so reform didn't work, top down state centric reform didn't work the first time, and yet we keep being told that we need more top down state centric reform. What is going on?
This is like a good parallel with what we see now.
Exactly.
After 20
reform,
years.
Reform at first is needed. Yeah. We're, you know, top down from the state in Kabul. When that doesn't work, fine. We have to solicit the help of the Soviet Union to help us reform. Okay.
Yeah.
That didn't work. Fine. Now we need the United States to implement top down reform. And that's the thing. It never ends. And it keeps initiating a cycle of events that just keeps to leading to more radicalism. Yeah. And at some stage, we have to sort of realize that this isn't how things work. And so a lot of these sort of big projects that were inaugurated and launched and finished, these were sort of initiated with the hopes that these would pay for themselves. But because society itself had not become on the industrial level, on the level of economic activity, those projects did not pay for themselves. You see? Because those projects also require the society and an economic base to make money, to generate revenue, to generate economic activity. And that's not what was happening in Afghanistan. And so we ended up with a massive, massive national debt.
I also think that this is a general problem with people who don't understand economics. They assume that you can create wealth out of thin air, basically. If we just take enormous loans or donations from another country and we start doing stuff, this will eventually result into something positive. And I must say that this is something that is very dangerous. It's a very dangerous idea. But it's very prevalent now here in the 21st century among many youth in Western countries. They idealize socialism and communism and etc. But in most cases, they don't understand that all these ideas that they think are very exciting, they have all been tried before.
Yeah.
And they have resulted into disasters. And with Daoud Khan, as someone who, this, by the way, before we go any further, I just want to make a public service announcement. Daoud Khan, we talk about him. We mentioned certain things that are not exactly very, how would you say it? They don't really portray him as a hero. But that doesn't mean that we believe that he was an evil man. We don't believe that he didn't have love and care for his people. This is a major, major issue that our listeners and our viewers need to understand, is that when we discuss important figures in our recent history in Afghanistan, we have to bear in mind that all these leaders, they cared about their country. They loved their people. They wanted Afghanistan to be a very prosperous, developed country where there is no poverty, where there's wealth and people are educated and people's lives are improved. And we have to give them credit for that, that they have this belief, they have this desire. However, as they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. They had good intentions, there's no doubt about it. But what we have to understand is that having mere good intentions does not mean that whatever you do will eventually have positive outcomes. And therefore, with Daoud Khan, so we discussed the constitutional decade. We discussed Musa Shafiq By the way, we're going to do a podcast about Musa Shafiq as well. Because Musa Shafiq, as Ahmed Walid Kakar briefly mentioned, he was the perfect political leader of his time. He was a man of religion. He was a man of worldly education and sciences. He spoke multiple languages. He understood economy. He understood politics. He was a very good administrator. In many ways, he would be the ideal figure who could actually bring Afghanistan into a next stage as a developed country. But sadly, he couldn't finish his mission. And
thanks to Dawood Khan.
Thanks to Dawood Khan. Yes.
But anyways,
okay.
Let's go to so.
Yes.
Afghanistan is gripped by these national crises.
Yes.
And in June 1973, King Mohammad Zahir Shah goes to Italy for eye surgery. I believe Dawood Khan launches a coup d'etat. And this coup d'etat is bloodless. There's people are not killed in it. And that is partly also because Dawood knows the ins and outs of the army because he has in his exile during the constitutional decade, cultivated alliances with the Parchami faction of the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, which is the Afghan Communist Party. And the Parchami faction, we can understand sort of as the Afghan Mensheviks, okay, the sort of the moderate urban intellectual Marxists. The Khalqi faction, we can understand as the Bolsheviks, right? I know this is a very sort of broad generalization, but just to make it easier, the Khalqis were sort of more drawn from rural stock, tended to be overwhelmingly Pashtun, and were more radical. So Dawood's cultivated these ties with the Parchamis. He launches a coup d'etat, and in his inaugural address, he announces a planned nationalization of major industries. He claimed that there had been conspiracies of an Islamist coup, and he also declared his intent to settle nomads and abolish what he called tribal life, okay, to really make Afghanistan a modern country. And in speaking to my family, family members of mine and whatever, I don't know if you know this, Sangeet, or if you've heard about it. In urban Afghan city life, Pashtuns, I think around this time, were also discouraged from using tribal names, okay, from tribal surnames. Sort of Pashtuns were encouraged to sort of adopt more family-centered surnames. And that was because Dawood saw the tribal system as something that was antithetical to the progress of Pashtuns. Now, obviously, that's really ironic and it's really ironic and rich coming from Dawood, because his republic, as we will see, was staffed very heavily on a tribal Pashtun basis of the Muhammad Zay. But in any case, it was these intentions and this inaugural address that earned him the label of the Red Prince. The former Prime Minister Maiwand Wal was implicated in this alleged Islamist coup, and he died in torture. Okay, Dawood's Parchami allies tortured him. Maiwand Wal, the Ahmad Zay, Wish Zalmay, died of his wounds because of old age. So that is kind of the context in which Dawood comes to power. Now, his presidency, we want to ask about his presidency. Dawood was in...
Just before you move on to his presidency, so how did he manage to get all these communists to support him and overthrow Zahir? Because obviously he was deposed as a prime minister, and then he was basically living an anonymous life for a while. He was banned from distancing himself from the royal family, because that's also something he tried. He wanted to break away from his tribal connection or family connection to the royal family.
So the royal family knew that Dawood was cultivating ties with leftists, but they... because obviously it was a sensitive issue and they knew that Dawood was a significant political player, they didn't confront him directly. But also, I guess there was the element of the royal family didn't think that Dawood, in their view, would be idiotic enough to basically challenge Muhammad Zay monarchy. From their perspective, they were sort of thinking, fine, he can do all of this stuff, but this is sort of a prince. This is a sardar. He's not going to bring down the family. But Dawood cultivated ties with these Parchamis and essentially proclaimed a republic. And in doing so, he obviously promised them not just a large share of power, but also enacting their agenda. And their agenda, like I said, he announced an intention to nationalize major industries, to make those state industries. He cracked down on Islamists, which is why he, Maywandwal, who was, you know, a patriotic man, died in custody. Maywandwal was very critical of Dawood and his reliance on the Soviet Union. If we look at the way in which Dawood ruled in his presidency, he ruled by decree from 1973 to 1977. He enacted 36 laws by presidential decree, which is something like, what, 36? Okay, 9 presidential decrees per year in a 4-year period. He had once again resumed a belligerent stance towards Pakistan. And by this point, Pakistan essentially used Afghan Ikhwanis or Islamists to start a revolt. And that revolt included people like Professor Burhanuddin Rabbanir, Engineer Saib Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, Maulawi Saib Jalaluddin Haqqani, Amir Saib Ahmad Shah Massoud. So these were the people that this uprising obviously failed. But especially with Maulawi Jalaluddin Haqqani, there was a real fear that this was essentially a communist government. The rank and file were communists. The people at the top, at the helm, were communists. Their agenda towards religion was very well known.
People in Afghanistan knew Dawood from his... They knew him from his... just 1 second. People in Afghanistan, they knew Dawood from his first era as a prime minister in the 1950s. Exactly. So they knew who they're dealing with when he... overthrew Zahir Khan. So obviously, this is something that I just want to clarify, is that when we look at Afghanistan's history, especially in the last 4 decades, what is often said is that these evil Ikhwanis, these radicals, slaves of Pakistan,
Ashrar,
these slaves of Pakistani ISI, they were against our progressive president. But they don't mention that this guy, Dawood Khan, who obviously wanted Afghanistan to be a modern, progressive, developed, prosperous nation, he was someone who had very close ties with communists. Close ties with Soviet Union. And so obviously, when the religious leaders in Afghanistan, the Islamic movement in Afghanistan, when they see that the regime is being overthrown and new leader is taking over, and this person is surrounded by people who are educated in Soviet Union, brainwashed into believing in dialectic materialism and Marxism, Leninism, and they are the guys who are basically the leadership of the army. They are the ones who are in command of the tank battalions and whatnot. What do you expect? What do you expect from people?
And not only that, the fact that Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto decided to help these people was also because of the fact that Dawood once again started the Pashtunistan issue. In a tit for tat, you know, in intra-state relations, Dawood was always very keen on supporting Baloch separatists, Pashtun separatists. So Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto decided to help these Islamic figures in revolting against a regime that they saw as being unduly influenced by communists. And so after 1975, this revolt obviously failed. Ahmad Shah Massoud fled to Pakistan. I believe Mawlawi Jalaluddin Haqqani waged a very low-level insurgency for even after that. He was never actually captured because government authority and lawyer Paktia, we know how it goes. But after this, Dawood also started to arrest other more mainstream Islamists. He even arrested many members of the Mujaddidi family, the Hazrats of Shorbazar, the heads of the Naqshbandi Sufi tariqah in Afghanistan. But after this failed revolt, Dawood started to remove his communist allies and started to replace them with Muhammad Zi, okay? Very Republican. But now what happened was that Dawood announced a 7-year plan that was due to start in 1976 that needed funding once again. So
the man of the 5-year plan, like the communists, now came with the 7-year plans.
Because the five-year plan
didn't work.
Exactly. But you see, the problem with this was that you mentioned as well that people knew Dawood, okay? And his announcement of a republic was not something that anyone really took seriously because it's the king's paternal cousin, right? Announcing a republic. So it was just, another one of those Muhammad Zi, okay? Now in power, he's just calling it a republic. But actually, if we look at it in real terms, the monarchy was perhaps, you know, Afghanistan's institutions had not developed in the constitutional decade to the extent to warrant public respect. And whilst the monarchy was far from perfect, it was at least the most credible insofar that there was a continuity there all the way from Ahmad Shah or Dost Mohammad Khan. Dawood did away with that. And so he announced a 7-year plan due to start in 1976. Once again, that needed funding. And now old problems rear their heads again because he was already heavily indebted to the Soviet Union, which was now scared of funding the plan totally because Afghanistan could default on its debts. So he traveled to Iran and the Middle East to attain the funding. And he was essentially told, look, you need to cut this Pashtunistan stuff out. You need to improve your relations with Pakistan. And it was after that that Dawood realized, okay, I can either keep my country financially afloat or I can continue to bang the Pashtunistan drum. And so Afghan media started to moderate anti-Pakistani propaganda. In 1976, July, Prime Minister Bhutto of Pakistan visited Dawood Khan. 1 month later, Dawood Khan visited Islamabad. And so there was sort of an understanding that was reached that whilst Pashtunistan was an issue, a thorn in bilateral relations, the two states would start to talk to each other to resolve this issue and cease the propaganda. And so coming back to the theme of republic, if we look at sort of the elite, the Afghan elite of the 1970s, primarily it consisted of Muhammad Zi and Karbalion. So amongst Pashtuns, Muhammad Zi were disproportionately represented. Amongst Farsi Wanan, Karbalis were disproportionately represented. But Muhammad Zi and other Pashtuns held the core of power in by way of the military. So in the backdrop of sort of warming relations between Iran and Afghanistan, Middle Eastern Arab states and Afghanistan, Pakistan and Afghanistan, the Soviet Union obviously started to become concerned. Dawood made a visit to the Soviet Union in 1977, and in a private meeting with Brezhnev told him that the presence of Western sort of experts, advisors on Afghanistan's northern borders was something that the Soviet Union considered hostile, that Afghanistan should not do this. Now, Dawood, we know, Lewanai Dawood, emotional man, very patriotic man, furiously, and this is documented, this is an Afghan nationalist propaganda, this is documented, this really happened. in this meeting, Dawood essentially very bluntly and rudely told Brezhnev that Afghanistan was an independent state, that Brezhnev had no right to intervene in Afghanistan's domestic affairs, and that the presence of any advisors in Afghanistan was the exclusive prerogative of the Afghan state. And it was after this that the Soviets realized that Dawood was essentially finished. Okay, he's turned irrevocably away from us, just like Anwar Sadat had done in Egypt. And so Soviet officials in Kabul were instructed to foster unity between Khalq and Parcham factions in Afghanistan, and Dawood needed to be disposed of. Furthermore, and this also has parallels to the present day, Russian planes started to fly sort of unauthorized flights in Afghan airspace to sort of intimidate Kabul, intimidate Dawood Khan. And Dawood Khan also reshuffled his cabinet once again, to the extent that by 1977, there was only one Marxist left. That was a Marxist that hid his own personal beliefs. And once again, he was replacing his cabinet, his communist ministers with, guess who, Sanger?
Mohammad Zahi.
Okay. So he made a final attempt to gain allies in the West and Middle East. He visited Egypt in 1978. He praised Anwar Sadat's treaty with Israel. But he also came back, and he also hung very notable, sentenced to death and hanged very notable Islamic scholars for their role in the alleged 1973 Islamist revolution.
I wanted to ask you a question. So you mentioned that Dawood Khan basically was forced to get rid of all these communists, and he stopped making overtures towards Soviet Union because Brezhnev insulted him, and he tried to mend his relationships with Pakistan. Now, when he did this, we are talking about a president who first initially started as a leftist person who is basically very, I don't know how to express that, but he was very friendly and he was friendly towards Soviet Union. I wouldn't say that he was a puppet of Soviet Union, obviously not. But then during his presidency, he did a 180 degree change. He changed course.
Yes.
Now, when he changed course, what was the reaction of his communist allies?
Well, his communist allies began to feel besieged, okay? Because at the outset, you can see that this alliance was not one that was supposed to last long. Dawood Khan was a Mohammad Zahi, okay? He was a prince, okay? Whilst he created the republic, he was definitely, he was basically a prince. He was very autocratic, and he was the beneficiary of a social and political order that was very much detested by his leftist allies, which they refer to as feudalism. And in this feudalist setup, Durrani, Mohammad Zahi, powerful landowners, politicians, were the primary beneficiaries, whilst peasants suffered, okay? But there was a bit of a, you had ideologues like Mir Akbar Khaybar, who we'll discuss in a bit, who essentially believed that their patriotic duty was to obey Dawood Khan no matter what, that this was their president and this was a patriotic president, that Afghanistan was not yet ripe for a Marxist revolution, and as such, they sort of needed to work within the system. And on the other side were those that were very deeply opposed to Dawood's increasing overtures to the imperialist powers, to the United States. There were the Pashtun nationalist sections of Khalq, who were very opposed to his overtures to Pakistan and his attempts to solve the Pashtunistan issue. And so the communists, in this sense, cannot be characterized as a monolith. There was quite a you know, dichotomy or trichotomy even.
Yes. Very important point, because we are doing this podcast on the occasion of the 43rd anniversary of the Communist Revolution. There is something that needs to be clarified here, is that communism as a political ideology from the 19th century has gone through different stages. Okay, you have this hardcore traditional communists who believe in Marxism, and they believe that conditions needs to be ripe for a revolution. You need to have a communist revolution in an industrialized state. If you study Marx, Marx predicted that the communist revolution will happen in Britain, because Britain was a country that was going through industrialization. And to much of his, you know, chagrin, it didn't happen in United Kingdom, but in Russia. And Russia was not a industrialized country. It was a basically a peasant economy. The most people lived from subsistence farming, and the communists like Lenin, who decided to overthrow the royal family, the Tsarist family in Russia, they did so by basically negating all these fundamental aspects of Marxism. And this is why we make a distinction between Marxism and Leninism. Okay? So the Khalqis in Afghanistan and to a large extent Parchamis were more inspired by Leninism. They believed that Afghanistan, despite being a very pre-modern country with no industry, they believed that if they overthrow the regime, if they become the rulers, then they can create a utopian communist state. Now, Mir Akbar Khaybar was a scholar among all these communists. He was a very well-read and well-educated communist who believed that Afghanistan could never become a communist country by simply overthrowing the regime. The circumstances weren't ripe for Afghanistan to become a communist regime. This is why he wanted to preserve the status quo. However, the other communists who were more inspired by Leninism, they disagreed. And basically, the army, the armed forces in Afghanistan, they were primarily Khalqis, who were the more
Bolsheviks.
Radical. The Bolsheviks, yes. Guys with big mustaches. and the Parchamis were the guys who were with the fancy pants, who were wearing very fancy clothes, and the urbanites. That was the difference between the Khalqis and the Parchamis. And basically, so Daoud Khan's regime was seen as undesirable by the more radical wing of the communists. So my next question for you, Walid, is that when the communists decided that this regime can no longer be tolerated, can you explain basically how they conspired against him? What happened exactly?
So we've noted that he basically pivoted away from his sort of communist allies, and he pivoted away at the same time from the Pashtunistan issue, which to some extent was interrelated. So in 1977, Dawood promulgated the new constitution. The new constitution, essentially, it had a couple of components. It relegated the Hanafi legal code significantly and made it secondary, not just to the new constitution, but also to presidential decree. So the 1931 constitution split law between state law and religious law. The 1964 constitution said that state law would not contravene the sacred tenets of the religion of Islam, and where state law was not sufficient, Hanafi law would be used instead. So it didn't relegate Hanafi law. It said that any law that the state implements will not be in contravention of the Hanafi law. Dawood's constitution basically relegated Hanafi law to presidential decrees, which he issued 36 of in 4 years, and his new constitution. It also instituted a one-party state called Milli Gorzang, okay? And everyone, including his communist allies, were pressured to join his new party, which was obviously not communist. But his new communist was also, sorry, his new constitution was also anti-communist, in that the stated aim was to allow Afghans to live a good life and to fulfill the basic principles of the sacred religion of Islam. Okay? Now, in April 17th, 1978...
Just 1 second.
Yes.
Don't forget what you were saying. Milli Gorzang means national movement. And it was a nationalist party.
Yes.
It had many parallels with Milliyet Hareket Partisi in Turkey. For our Turkish listeners, Milliyet Hareket Partisi is a Turkish nationalist party inspired by, obviously, Atatürk. And Davut Khan's Milli Gorzang party was sort of a Afghan version of the same thing.
So what you have is that, so Dawood's pivot towards the anti-communist camp is very prominent in the foreign and the domestic spheres. He's replaced almost all of his communist ministers with Mohammad Zayi. And after coming back from his visit in 1978, on April the 17th, Mir Akbar Khaybar is shot and killed. Okay? And no one really knows to this day who killed Mir Akbar Khaybar. Dawood was blamed. Engineer Saib Gulbuddin Hikmatyar has also taken credit for killing him. People have blamed Babrak Karmal. People have blamed Hafizullah Yameen. But because this killing was seemingly unprovoked, it drew massive protests. Okay, tens of thousands of people took to the streets, and Dawood was alarmed. So what Dawood did was he arrested the ringleaders of the communists, like Nur Muhammad Taraki, like Babrak Karmal, and his stated intentions, according to his insiders, was that according to his new penal code, these would be imprisoned for a period of something like 4 to 7 years. However, they feared the worst. They feared that Dawood would kill them. So Hafizullah Amin made an appeal, a desperate appeal, to Khalqi officers in the bases of Bagram and Rishkhor to start an insurrection to depose Dawood. And that started on the 27th. On the 27th, Dawood chaired a cabinet meeting to discuss how to quell the sort of unrest. And that meeting was interrupted with sounds of military aircraft, of tanks, of street-to-street fighting. And as such, on the 27th, this Sawar revolution began. Dawood's entire family were killed. His wife, his children, all of them were killed. A battle ensued for the night. Dawood rejected a second offer of surrender from the Khalqis. And by the next morning, Dawood, his brother Muhammad Naeem, and the remaining loyalists were dead. And that was the Sawar revolution, led essentially by Hafizullah Amin, who was essentially the coordinator and the leader of these Khalqi officers in the army, who was himself a very staunch Leninist, also very noted Pashtun nationalist on the Durand Line issue. And that was the end of Dawood Khan, Sardar Muhammad Dawood Khan, And we live with the consequences of that revolution, of that coup d'etat to this day. And not just with the consequences of the revolution and the coup d'etat, but also the policies that Sardar Mohammed Daoud Khan himself pursued. We live with those today.
Okay. Now, we have basically discussed Daoud Khan from his birth to his death. Obviously, in very broad strokes. Mm-hmm. But we can't go into much details. This is just a podcast. But now let's just reflect on some of the things that you have discussed, especially the assassination of Mirakbar Khaybar. Khaybar was assassinated. His assassination resulted into mass protests by the communists, and the protests were then seen as a threat by Dawood, and Dawood then started imprisoning them, and when they started feeling the threat, they said, you know what, it's time to overthrow the regime, assassinate him. There is something that has emerged recently. Famous communist poet, politician, Sulaiman Laik. He has died recently. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Sulaiman Laik was a Parchami. He was involved in the party from the early days. He was very close to Babrak Karmal and Mirakbar Khaybar. We may do a podcast about him. I met him 15 years ago. I'm not sure, but he was here in the Netherlands. He was in a family gathering with other people that I know. His son has recently posted something on his Facebook page where basically Sulaiman Laik is saying that Babrak Karmal was the one who was responsible for assassination of Mirakbar Khaybar. Now, this is something that has emerged recently. There is something else that we need to understand about the revolution. And this is what I have heard from people from inside the party, the Communist Party. You alluded to this. But this is a very important aspect of foreign meddling in Afghanistan. The Soviet Union obviously saw the communists in Afghanistan as their assets. However, this is a strategy of the communists, but all other states, when they want to meddle in Afghanistan's affair, they don't put all their eggs in one basket. They establish relationships with different groups, secret relationships with different groups. So the Khalqis, they had their relationship with Soviet Union. The Parchamis had their relationship with the Soviet Union. The Setamis, who are basically the Tajik nationalists who believe that Afghanistan is like apartheid South Africa. These guys, they had their relationship with Soviet
Union. But even they're interesting because they broke away from the Sholeis.
Yes, yes. And the Sholeis are communists who believe in Maoism. So we discussed Marxism, we discussed Leninism. Maoism is another strand of communism, which is even more radical than Leninism, and we will in future, inshallah, we will have a podcast where we discuss Maoism, because people who have a very important roles in this current regime in Afghanistan, they used to be Maoists. And speaking of those people, Daulat Waziri, a very prominent figure in this current government in Afghanistan, was a Khalqi who was part of Amin's crew. Okay. Dawlat Waziri was a spokesman. He had many important roles in the last 20 years in the current government. He was part of Amin's crew. And Masoum Stanakzai, who is the leader of the negotiating team of the Republic in Doha, he was also part of the Khalqis who were involved in overthrowing Dawood Khan and assassinating him and massacring his entire family. But Dawood Khan, when he was killed, obviously these Khalqis, they created their own regime. And a lot of figures from the Khalqi regime, basically they have evolved into different roles, and they've always been active in Afghanistan's politics. So, like, for instance, Masoum Stanakzai, he was also working in the government during President Najibullah's era. And Masoum Stanakzai was, I believe, also involved in Shahnawaz Tanai's coup against Najib.
Featuring engineer Saib Hikmatyar.
Yeah, so Masoum Stanakzai was involved in overthrowing Dawood Khan. Then he was involved in trying to overthrow Najib because he was in an alliance with arch rivals of the Khalqis, the Islamists. And now, in the last 20 years, he is in the current government. He was head of NDS, I believe, and he was senior advisor of President Ashraf Ghani, and now he is the main negotiator on behalf of the Republic in Doha. There is another person who is currently the governor of Khost. His name is Momand Katawazay. This man, he was a tankist during the coup against Dawood Khan. He was driving a tank when Dawood was killed. And Momand Katawazay is now a governor in Khost, and he was the main leader of the garrison, I think, in Balkh, where the Taliban basically massacred all those soldiers. It happened a few years ago. So when we talk about Afghanistan's recent history, when we talk about the communist coup that resulted into the war, which eventually led to Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the culprits, the people who were involved in that coup, they are still in power. They are still in current government. A lot of these young guys with these suits and these tight pants who work now for the current government in the Argin administrative office of the president, they are sons of Khalqis and Parchamis who were involved in the coup. So we have a continuation of the same group, tight-knit group of people who basically are the architects of the misery and pain of Afghans for the last 40 years. And the same people are still in power. So when we want to understand why is Afghanistan still in a mess, why is Afghanistan still going through all this pain and suffering, it's because we have a group of people who repeatedly return back into the highest echelons of the government, and they have a major role in how our politics, our society, all of these matters, all these issues, how they evolve and develop. And as long as we will have these people in power in Afghanistan, I believe that we will not have any kind of closure, because as Afghans, we need to break away from the influence of these radical leftists. These radical leftists are the people who have created Afghanistan's current problems. While I would say that Dawood Khan, he was a progressive and he had many similarities with these communists. He had sort of similar ideas and beliefs. Still, he was less radical and less fanatic as these people. And their extremism, their bloodthirst was the reason why Afghanistan eventually ended up in a first a civil war and then Soviet occupation.
So that was Daoud Khan covered in depth, obviously with generalizations. We could go into a lot more detail concerning the specific events that led to the coup. That was a summary of Daoud Khan's politics, his ideas, his vision for a modern Afghanistan, his shortcomings, his failures, and the coup which has led us to where we are today, which started off, the coup itself, started off very much where we are right now. And that is a project, a top-down project, aimed at socially engineering Afghanistan's populace that led to the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan by one superpower, followed by the invasion and occupation by another superpower, whom the first communists had now allied with in order to wage a brutal war against Afghanistan's own people, rural, urban, without taking into account the cultural, societal, religious, economic framework in which Afghanistan operates. And so with that in mind, I hope everyone enjoyed our podcast. And I hope, above all, more than anything, that we can look at this period of our history and see it without the rose-tinted glasses, but also see it for what what we are missing from those eras, and especially sort of a time where there was the appreciation, at least at face value, for Afghanistan's through the framework within which Afghanistan operates. And so with that in mind, I'd like to wrap up this podcast. It was quite exhaustive, but I hope that everyone can take some lesson from it and realize that socially engineering a country, trying to turn millions of people into something that they're not overnight by force of arms, whether that's secular, whether that's Islamic, that is not the role of the state. And in a country like Afghanistan, that has only led and is only leading to unmitigated disaster. So if you haven't subscribed to our YouTube channel already, please do so. Press the notification bell if you haven't. And please please consider becoming patrons on our Patreon page. Like I said in the beginning, what we're all about is changing the way in which Afghanistan is spoken about and changing the way in which Afghanistan is understood. If you too are bored and quite frankly cringe every single time people share that same damn picture of women in miniskirts in Kabul universities at some point in the 70s as some sort of golden age, if you too are sick of that, then join in our cause. Email us at info@afghani.org so you can send us your recommendations, suggestions, topics that you want to better understand. Help us to help you understand Afghanistan better, and together we can change the way in which Afghanistan is spoken about in the world at large, because if we Afghans don't do this for each other, the mainstream media is not going to do it either. And they've been talking about us for the last century, and they haven't been doing it on the terms that we understand with the values that we cherish. If we don't help each other, who will? And with all of that out of the way, I'd like to thank Sangar Paikar, the host of the Afghan Eye podcast. I guess I'd like to thank myself as well, because it's a bit awkward if I don't. But in any case,
you do deserve a lot of praise for what you do. Praising someone in front of them is obviously unethical from an Islamic perspective. But I have to say, your research, the time you invest in doing your research, studying, gathering information, all the books that you've studied, all the papers that you've studied for each and every episode, for all the articles, I think people need to know how much time Ahmad Waleed Kakar invests in his work, what he does, it is something that people really need to start appreciating. Every day, if I look at what we have created so far, all these episodes, all these articles, the praise and love that we receive from our audience, I'm very thankful, and I'm very happy that we're doing this as a team. So I want to also really thank you from the bottom of my heart for all that you do.
It's a duty for those of us who can to be able to do something. And I think above all, we should thank the people that support us either financially, who give us feedback, who give us their recommendations and suggestions, and our patrons and the people who have donated to us on PayPal. I think more than myself, they deserve all of the credit and praise, because a small freelance and independent project like ours cannot survive, and indeed, as it has expanded, it cannot expand without the help and support of our viewers, listeners, readers, subscribers, patrons, and everyone else. So thank you very much, guys. I hope everyone's Ramadan is going well. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.